The plan this afternoon is that, first of all, Dirk van Meertvoel will speak. Afterwards, there will be the presentation from Paul Botley, introduced by Jackie Stedahl. Jackie Stedahl unfortunately has to leave in the course of the afternoon, so I'm not sure if you'll be here for the discussion or not. And the idea is to have a discussion of both papers after the presentation of Paul Botley. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce Dirk van Meert, who will be well known to many of you here. His background is in Spanish and Latin literature and language, which make him eminently qualified for work on the Skalliger project. And he was, I think, involved 4 or 5 years in this particular project at the Warburg Institute and continues to be involved, of course, today, although he is now based at the Huygens Institute at The Hague in the Netherlands, where he is currently completing a volume on biblical criticism from academic setting to public debate, 1575 to 1675. This will be a particularly welcomed monograph. He's also completed 2 other volumes, very pertinent to this particular series. One is Observations in Early Modern Letters, and the other is an edition of is a monograph on Eric Vossius, which he is producing with Eric Joring. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dirk van Meert to talk on, let me just find the talk, the 17th Century Culture of Editing Scholarly Correspondences, the Case of Joseph Skalliger.
Now, without further ado, if we today speak of a culture of knowledge, we use this in the first place as one of our own conceptual tools with which we approach the learned world of the early modern period. A 17th century scholar would have recognized this more or less as what he tended to call the Republic of Letters. And this term was already in use in the early 16th century, and it remained a vital concept in the self-conceptualization of the learned world until the beginning of the 19th century. The term itself, res publica literaria, is a very stable one, but the reality behind it is described in different ways depending on time and on geography. This is demonstrated by a number of studies on the Republic of Letters. In fact, the stability of the term itself obfuscates that this community of scholars changed over time, both when it comes to their practices, but also when it comes to their ideals. I think what still needs to be done today is to write the history of the Republic of Letters chronologically and map its development over time. What I'll try to do in this paper is identify one of the developments in the Republic of Letters. I think that the 17th century witnessed a shift in the way scholars dealt with the publication of learned correspondences. The Republic of Letters manifests itself to us in various ways, and most emphatically as a collection of distinguishable but interwoven networks of scholars held together by correspondence and dependent on lines of communication which often followed commercial and diplomatic routes. Writing letters was the daily business of the citizens of this Republic of Letters. The 17th century scholar Johannes Gravius, for example, complained that 20% of his salary was spent on postage. Letter writing was considered so important that before the 17th century, scholars often published their own letters. Petrarch in the 14th century, Cardinal Bessarion, Leonardo Bruni, Francesco Filelfo, Aeneas Silvio Piccolomini in the 1470s, followed not much later by people like Gian Antonio Campano, Pica della Mirandola, Marsilio Ficino, Poliziano, Robert Gaguin, and others. Now, all of these people carefully selected, edited, and published part of their letters, often adding completely fictitious letters as well. Now, these collections fulfilled a need for self-presentation in a system of patronage. The self-promoting activities of such letter writers have been the subject of a number of new historicist studies during the past few decades, and the picture which emerges from these studies is one of individuals creating public images of themselves through the controlled publication and often the rewriting and censoring of their own letters. Now, I'm getting the impression that the 17th century takes this culture of knowledge to a completely new level. What basically changes is that individuals leave it more and more often to posterity to publish their correspondences. And indeed, posterity is starting to care for the preservation of the achievements of their immediate predecessors. In other words, humanist self-presentation gave way to posthumous presentation by students and relatives, presentation of the heroes of scholarship, the princes of the Republic of Letters. What we see emerging then is a conscious effort to promote a culture of knowledge by groups of scholars, defining themselves as a group, as a community. Geographically, this activity was concentrated in Northern Europe. The Netherlands, the Low Countries, the Dutch, the German territories, and France. This brings me to number two on your handout. Now, this growing awareness of a collective responsibility is a sign, I think, of increasing professionality in the world, in the learned world. In the course of the 17th century, the world of scholarship was becoming more and more institutionalized, and we know this, of course, from the creation of the academies, the British. The Royal Academy and the one in Paris, which facilitated research. And we know this also from the emergence of scholarly and scientific journals in the second half of the 17th century. But apart from journals and academies, there are also other signs. There are, for example, publications providing information on recent scholarship, which were mushrooming. For instance, biobibliographies of the Re Cantiores, the recent authors. And these provided overviews of lives, often with appendices of publications of these scholars. Or take, for example, the posthumous publication of anecdotes and quotations of scholars, known in French as the genre of les Anna, the Scaligerana, the Tuana, the Peroniana, etc., or known in English better as the genre of the table talk. Another sign of the time is the appearance of the variorum editions of classical texts, which are encyclopedias of scholarships, exhaustive archives listing which authorities said what about single sentences or verses of ancient authors. We have to regard the posthumous publication of correspondences in this light. They were edited not only to honor the heroes of the past, but also to facilitate reflection by the community of scholars on their own immediate past, thus allowing for the building of a tradition. There even start to appear printed keys to the edited correspondences. And these keys presented identifications of authors and book titles. They almost function as footnotes. And in fact, footnotes started to become a normal phenomenon in 18th century editions of scholarly correspondences, when the indexes to such editions also became more and more sophisticated. Now, the posthumous publication of correspondences is, I think, then part of an increasing institutionalization of the Republic of Letters. And today I'd like to look at one of the most exemplary posthumously published correspondences. This is the edition of the letters of Joseph Scaliger. Let me first speak about the letters which are found in Scaliger's opuscula. Now, often behind the posthumous publications of these letters were central figures in the Republic of Letters. In the first half of the 17th century, one such figure was the Leiden scholar Daniel Heinsius. Heinsius had been Joseph Scaliger's star pupil, and via Scaliger, he also was a regular correspondent of Isaac Casaubon, about whom Paul is going to tell a bit more in a minute. Heinsius was also one of the key advisors to the Leiden publishing house of the Elseviers. He had special preference for the edition of letters, apart from being a Neo-Latin poet and a scholar of Greek and of Aristotle and all sorts of other subjects. Now, already in 1617, Heinsius edited an anthology of letters of lesser-known scholars, diplomats and governors, which dealt mainly with matters of state and church. So not surprising, we have since long known that he was involved in the famous 1627 edition of the letters of Scaliger. And afterwards, he was also lurking in the background during the decade which led up to the publication of the letters of Isaac Casaubon in 1638. And that particular edition was in many ways the twin sister of the Scaliger letters. Now, until now, we have always thought of Heinsius as the sole driving force behind the edition of Scaliger's correspondence. But was he? And the obvious source for checking is his own correspondence, but ironically, his own letters were never published. At the time, privileged visitors have given worrying accounts of the chaotic state of Heinsius' study. And there were papers scattered all over the place, so he probably wasn't as organized with his own papers as he was with the papers of other people. Nonetheless, I had the opportunity to look at much of his unpublished correspondence, and some of these letters show that the Scaliger project was not initiated by Heinsius himself. At least two similar projects preceded it. And after he had taken over the project, it was supported by large segments of the Protestant Republic of Letters, involving the help of a network of dedicated scholarly agents. Moreover, it will turn out that the posthumous publishing of Scaliger's correspondence was part of a much larger effort to publish his papers and his treatises, an effort supported by various people in three different countries. Now, what did Scaliger himself say about what should happen to his papers, his unpublished papers? We then should have to look at Scaliger's will. Now, Scaliger bequeathed his unpublished papers to Leiden University Library, but on the condition that none of these be published, for these papers contain not only unpublished material, but also unfinished material. Now, the will says nothing about Scaliger's letters or other works from his hand which he had actually sent to other people, often as attachments to the letters he sent. And these are short essays, treatises, occasional poems, lists of corrections, remarks, charts, tables, drawings of monuments, of inscriptions, etc. And such sources of information were too large to be inserted into the body of the letter itself, and often the recipients detached these appendices from the letters and filed them separately, very much like we today sort of file attachments we add to our emails. Now, in the case of Scaliger, a number of such treatises he sent to correspondents in Paris, and Scaliger's will is completely silent about what should be done to these treatises. In fact, a number of these small works were already printed during Scaliger's life in the first edition of the Opuscula. In 1605 appeared that first edition in Paris. Scaliger did not initiate this edition, and he did not oversee it, and he was actually quite annoyed that some corrections which he sent to the editor, Charles Labbé or Carolus Labbéus, came too late to be inserted. Isaac Casaubon, who was very close to Labbéus, promised Scaliger that in the next edition everything would be settled. So here we have one reason why Casaubon prepared an expanded version of the Opuscula in 1610. Now, as Scaliger's man in Paris, Casaubon received numerous letters from Scaliger, and he read many more letters which Scaliger addressed to other Parisians, who were well known to Casaubon, people like Jacques Auguste Thou, Jacques and Pierre Dupuis, Jacques Gillot, and others. These men regularly met at the library of de Thou, where the basis was laid of what later was to become known as the Cabinet Dupuis. For Casaubon, then, it was easy to lay hands on letters and treatises which Scaliger had sent to members of this Parisian group. Now, Scaliger at times had, in his letters, had asked Casaubon not to share the contents of his letters with others, and as Casaubon himself fostered strong opinions about the difference between work for private communication and work for the public sphere, he was careful in making his selection from these letters and treatises. Now, from Casaubon's preface to the Opuscula, we are led to believe that it was in fact de Thou who had asked Casaubon to undertake the edition. Casaubon writes he would have preferred Scaliger to publish the material by himself, but Scaliger had replied that he had written many works on demand, works of which he had not kept any copies. Casaubon, in his preface, was careful to account for his choices and for his sources as well. He made sure that he printed only genuine works, but Casaubon limited himself to what he could find in Paris only. He also made sure not to print anything that Scaliger had forbidden to print. Casaubon also discusses the status of every work involved, identifying the sources he relied on. When he came to Scaliger's letters, Casaubon expressed the wish that one day someone would publish them all. This is going to be the motto for our edition. Casaubon also stated that he had asked Daniel Heinsius to supply some works. So why Heinsius? Because Heinsius, as a librarian of Leiden University Library and as Scaliger's favorite student, had been responsible for guarding the legacy of Scaliger in Leiden University Library. Heinsius was unwilling, however, to send the material because of Scaliger's prohibition to publish anything. Casaubon envied the Dutch, he wrote, who not only possessed Scaliger during all those years which Scaliger spent in Leiden, but who even continued to do so after Scaliger's death. Casaubon wished that things would have been otherwise and that France would not have been robbed of these treasures. Now, if one reads between the lines here in this preface, one can basically interpret these words as critique on Heinsius, that Heinsius had not actually come round to sending that material which Casaubon had asked for. The correspondence with Heinsius to which Casaubon refers is actually still extant. So we were able, from the correspondence, to check whether what Casaubon writes in this preface is actually true or not. Now, this exchange actually does corroborate Casaubon's account. Heinsius was reluctant to send Casaubon the material he had asked for, for example, a numismatic treatise by Scaliger. Casaubon wrote to people close to Heinsius and he mobilized the authority of the two, so he set up a sort of campaign to put pressure on Heinsius. In February 1610, for example, then Heinsius finally replied to Casaubon, expressing joy that Scaliger's small works were now being printed in Paris, but he regretted that he couldn't comply with Casaubon's request to send more material from Scaliger's legacy, due to Scaliger's own prohibition. But Heinsius does approve of printing letters, and I now quote from a letter from Heinsius. When he was still alive, Scaliger showed himself not terribly opposed to this idea, the many times I told him this was going to happen. Unquote. Nevertheless, Casaubon and Heinsius kept on quarrelling for some time, Heinsius defending himself that he saw no legal way of getting around Scaliger's last will. Now, the opuscula were republished 2 years later in Frankfurt in 1612 by an unknown editor. The major difference with the previous edition is that this last one contains 49 letters from Joseph Scaliger which are not present in the edition of 1610. And these concern letters to three German scholars, to Lipsius, to John Isaac Pontanus, and to Pierre Pitou. But the vast majority of these new letters are addressed to Janus Gruter. So one might suspect that Gruter was actually behind this edition, although the letters to Gruter do not give a particularly flattering impression of him. Be it as it may, this Frankfurt edition at least attempted to give more space to Scaliger's German context and put his German network on the map. Now, what this story of the edition history of the Opuscula tells us is that the canonization of Scaliger was not just the work of Heinsius and not just the work of the Leiden circle around him. The Paris circle of Pierre Dupuis, of Isaac Casaubon and Jacques-Auguste Thou was equally important. And it also shows that Scaliger's legacy was appropriated by a German editor and a Frankfurt printer. Now, these conclusions are confirmed if we jump to the second major collection of letters of Scaliger, which saw the light and which is usually considered the standard edition, that by Heinsius, which was published in Leiden in 1627. This famous edition was first initiated by Pierre Dupuis and not by Daniel Heinsius. In 1620, Dupuis came up with the idea to publish letters from Scaliger, but he seems to have envisioned a book with letters from famous men, so not just letters from Scaliger only. As soon as Heinsius heard of the plans, he started to advise Dupuis on the edition, and he wrote, and this is text one on your handout, "Please let me know by a letter what your plans are concerning the letters of Scaliger and their edition. I would persuade you to add Casaubon's replies to them, which I can supply you with. For there are many issues which remain difficult to understand if the answers to the letters are not added. There could also be added several letters from other people. This will make the volume more substantial and increase its authority." Two months later, Heinsius again wrote to Dupuis about the planned edition. This is text two on your handout. "As far as the letters of learned men are concerned," note of learned men, not just of Scaliger, "of which I understand you are busy preparing an edition shortly to be published, I'm sure you will also add letters from other people and not just from Casaubon and Scaliger. I'm not quite sure what your plan is. You have to know that everything which is here with us in Leiden is at your disposal." Unquote. Hence, in 1621, Heinsius planned to send Dupuis some letters of Casaubon as well. Now, we don't hear anything more about the project until 3 years later, when it is mentioned in a completely different context. That's to say, in a letter between two German scholars. In November 1624, Ludovicus Camerarius wrote to Georg Michael Lingelsheim that the Germans were much indebted to Matthias Bernegger, who was very committed in searching for letters from Scaliger. Lingelsheim himself had collected Scaliger's letters to German scholars, and he had asked his friend Bernegger to ask for Scaliger's letters anywhere else. And indeed, we have two letters from Bernegger to German scholars, written in 1624, both asking for letters from Scaliger for the benefit of the people from Leiden, the Lugdunenses. And 2 years later, in 1626, it becomes clear that it was in fact Heinsius himself who was in charge of the edition. So the tables have turned, and it's not Dupuis in Paris anymore who is working on an edition which includes letters from or even to Scaliger, but it is Heinsius in Leiden. And in 1626, Heinsius wrote to Dupuis in Paris that he hoped to immortalize Scaliger by publishing his letters. Our most interesting piece of evidence, however, is a letter from June 1626, which Heinsius addressed to Dupuis, and it's worth citing at length. And this is your the last text on your handout, text 3. Now Scaliger's letters. It is a treasure for which all men will forever be indebted to you, Dupuis. But I easily understand the reason why you ordered that your name should not be mentioned in the edition. As soon as I saw these letters, I thought nothing would have been more desirable than that a selection would be published, because they are not all the same, and not all are worthy of the man we admire so much. The letters he wrote with a view to publishing, as the one on the history of the Scaliger family, which I ordered to be printed before all the others, together with some letters which Casaubon has printed, these letters surpass all doubts of his genius and eloquence. And that was Casaubon's reason to publish these letters in particular, although he had many more letters. Several of the other letters, if you ignore the purity of style which Scaliger maintained everywhere, seem to have been written without care, because writing extemporarily usually suffices in such matters. Some letters he wrote when he was busy doing other things, and in those you'll find no more than hello and goodbye. For nobody is cautiously restrained towards friends or thinks about posterity if he drops a friend a line. Because Scaliger was aware of this, he forbade that even the work he wrote with a little more attention be published after his death under a serious oath, with which he strictly and completely bound his friends. That oath is Scaliger's will. Among these works is extant here his diatribe about the equinoxes, which my late brother-in-law Rudgersius has published in Paris, and you are well aware how much controversy that publication led to. I know some people who attack him daily in Scaliger's name on this issue. I, Heinsius, did leave out a few letters. The printer, a type of people which usually doesn't listen to someone else's opinion and only cares for profit, gave in somewhat. Printers love large size, whereas it is usually a burden to readers and even more to buyers. I myself also added not a few letters, some of which are polished and above all learned. Unquote. Now this glance into the 17th century editorial practices shows us Heinsius struggling to find a balance between the printer's wish for size, his reader's expectations for selectivity, and his own inclination to select on the basis of style and contents. We also see him evaluating the editorial principles of one of his predecessors, of Casaubon, who had been more selective than he himself. So Heinsius is excusing himself for the relatively large number of letters which carry little weight in his eyes, because they were not always up to the standards when it came to style and contents. He was unwilling to expose some of Scaliger's careless letters, but the printer disagreed, so Heinsius did add more letters, some of which were fine, but about the quality of others he is silent. Now, according to the printers of the 1627 edition, the Elsevier brothers, Heinsius had asked everyone for letters from Scaliger. The Elseviers printed the bunch of letters which Heinsius handed over to them, and they themselves added a couple of letters more which friends had sent to them after the proofs of the first batch was already finished. It would appear then that the printers too took an active role in the assembling of the letters. The letters came from the press in 1627. To account for the project, Heinsius, in the letter to the reader, which was printed anonymously, complained about the bad quality of the letters as printed in the Paris and Frankfurt editions of 1612 and 1610 in the Opuscula. Heinches had emendated these letters, but he admitted that some mistakes he must have overlooked, for the orthographs were lacking, and Heinches could only conjecture. And he finished by requesting his readers to send any letters from Casaubon they had to André Rivet, a scholar in Leiden, because Rivet was starting preparations for an edition of the correspondence of Casaubon, which was due to appear a decade later. It's time now to draw some conclusions. If we compare this story with the practices of, for example, Lipsius, who carefully edited his own letters, or his successor in Leuven, Ericius Putianus, who did the same thing, there's a clear difference. Whereas from Petrarch to Lipsius, Eunice had often tried to control their own public profile by means of carefully editing their own letters, it would seem to me that after the turn of the century, learned men started increasingly left it to posterity to publish their letters. And posterity did publish these letters because they told something, not only about style, but also about the factual history of scholarship. There was, I think, a growing sense of the importance of mapping the recent history of one's own discipline. And in fact, I think this concern about the recent past was a symptom of increasing professionalization and perhaps even disciplinarization. Letter collections are often staged as an instrumentum to a scholar's work. Emphasis is shifting from importance of style towards scholarly contents later on in the 17th century. One can also see that the collective enterprise of posthumous edition was not limited to correspondences, but also moved to include other works. This is demonstrated by the list of posthumous publications which followed the Opuscula. You can see a list at the end of your handout. There's a whole list of of small treatises by Scaliger, published posthumously by members of the family of Heinches, by former students, by people from Leiden. Now, this shows how many former students and members from the Leiden circle felt compelled to honor their one-time master and erect monuments for him, but also that there was an urgent sense of the importance to preserve the scholarly past, the recent scholarly past. In other words, shortly after Scaliger's death, I think a new culture of knowledge was emerging within the Republic of Letters.
Thank you, Dirk. And now we're going to continue with Paul Bockley, who has worked with Dirk, of course, very closely. Paul's background is in Renaissance and early modern literature. He's presently a Scaliger Fellow at the Warburg Institute. He has several publications coming out soon. Learning Greek in Western Europe, coming out this year, yes. Any day. The Correspondence of Joseph Scaliger, which you've worked on with Dirk, and also the Correspondence of Isaac Casaubon, which you've done an inventory for, but you're doing an online edition.
This is what I'm about to say.
And that's what you're about to say.
Okay.
Together with Richard Thompson, you're also going to
speak. Oh, Richard Thompson, yes, my favourite man, Richard Thompson.
Right, what I have to say is actually relatively brief. I have a handout here, it's for the second half of the paper. What I have essentially are two micro papers. So if you drift off of the first one, you can pick it up in the second one. It's a sort of appendix to what Dirk has been saying. These are two projects that have essentially been spun out of the Scaliger project. One of them is about Isaac Casaubon. You already had something of an introduction.
Shall I hand out these?
No. Now these are profs, so I need to hand them out. These are just for the second half, so you don't need them yet. Isaac Casaubon, I hope you know something about Casaubon now, even if you didn't know when you came into the room, but I imagine that Casaubon is a relatively familiar figure to at least some of you. The other person I'm going to talk about today is Richard Thompson. Now, I imagine that probably no one knows about Richard Thompson. I often ask people, have you heard of Richard Thompson? And almost no one. In fact, I've never found anyone who said, oh yes, Richard Thompson. So after today, this is also the first ever paper given, as far as I can tell, in the whole world on Richard Thompson. So at least there's a first there anyway, whatever the quality of what I'm about to say. So I'm going to start with Casaubon. Now, I should briefly outline his life, just in case your memory of his biography is a bit rusty. Son of a Protestant minister, began his career teaching at the University of Geneva in the 1580s. He stayed in Geneva about 15 years, and I think he probably stayed there for longer if they'd managed to pay him properly. But eventually he took a position at Montpellier. He was only there for about 2 years, from 1597. He then received an invitation from Henri IV to go to Paris. I say an invitation, I've seen this invitation, it's only grammatically a request. The original survives, it's nice to see, a sort of royal summons, very short, come to Paris. So he went to Paris. He was in Paris about 10 years. He was a Protestant intellectual at the heart of a court that was becoming increasingly Roman Catholic, and this put him in a very difficult position. He made some attempts to find a more comfortable home. These all failed until Henri was assassinated, and Henri, as his great patron and protector, his assassination was a big problem. So Casaubon very quickly accepted a position at the English court from James IV. Once he was in a Protestant court, he threw himself with great enthusiasm into Protestant and religious controversy. You get the sense that this is what he'd always wanted to do, but he couldn't do it in Paris. Now, my interest in Casaubon emerged from our interest in Scaliger. In the course of compiling the inventory of Scaliger's correspondence, we noticed that the single largest subset of this corpus was the correspondence with Casaubon. There are 254 surviving letters between the two men. That is probably something like all of the letters that arrived safely. It's not all the letters that each of them wrote, but it's probably something like what they got. As Dirk pointed out, a selection of this correspondence between Scaliger and Casaubon was among the first of Scaliger's letters ever to be printed in 1610 by Casaubon after Scaliger's death. Now, this portion of the correspondence interested me for several reasons. First, it's largely complete, which is remarkable. Second, it's very large and complete, which is also remarkable. Perhaps the most interesting thing is that the two men trusted each other completely. And this is... Casaubon really needed a confidant. He was isolated in Paris. He needed someone he could talk to, and his judgment he could trust. And he really trusted Scaliger's judgment. So there's an intimacy to the correspondence which makes it interesting. And to have this intimacy conducted in this very, very learned language is extraordinarily interesting. It's particularly interesting because Casaubon moves into and out of Greek with a facility that is unmatched. And this makes it possible for him to have a range of allusion and a range of a possibility of connecting with the knowledge of his recipient, very, very specific, very detailed knowledge, which is, I've never met anything quite like it. And that sense of intimacy and immense complexity, I find it extremely attractive. So I started poking around. This led me to 5 substantial manuscripts in the British Library, which is where I found the summons. These were put together by Isaac's son, Merrick, someone else you may have heard of. Now, after Isaac's death in London in 1614, the majority of the manuscripts were sent to his widow, Florence, in Paris. And they were, as it were, the property both of Florence and of Casaubon's oldest son, Jean. Now, Jean entered a monastery, so the papers of the great Protestant father figure became a less desirable property, perhaps, from his point of view. Anyway, Merrick, as it were, came into this inheritance. He was about 19 years old. He'd just graduated from Christ Church. One of many acts of filial piety which he indulged in was to take all of these letters, these are almost entirely letters to Casaubon, and he arranged them in alphabetical order by correspondent. He bound them in 5 volumes, and these 5 volumes are in the British Library today. Now, leafing through these manuscripts, the first thing that struck me was that the vast majority of these letters are unpublished. They're extraordinarily interesting. They're also only one half of a conversation. Much of the other half of the conversation that Casaubon had, the Casaubon letters, has been published, but this half is largely unpublished. Dirk touched on the publication history of Casaubon very, very briefly. Just to outline it, we have an edition of 1638. Google Books has digitised it, so you can all have a copy. 1656 was the second edition. The first edition had about 640 letters. The second one added about 80 letters, previously unpublished. 1709, the third and last edition, massive, beautiful folio, has a fantastic engraving of Casaubon's bladder, which is what killed him. Very, very striking. I think possibly the only 18th century edition to include an image of a bladder.
Not in my edition, actually.
It's not?
No, it's cut out.
Oh, has it? Well, someone obviously put it on their wall. Anyway, the 1709 edition is beautiful. If you go to the University of Mannheim website, it's been immaculately digitized and can be consulted in all sorts of ways. This added maybe 300 letters to the total. So we have a very substantial volume of corpus of letters built up now. Most of what is published, though, is still letters by Casaubon. Okay, so I then thought, well, what else do we have apart from the British Library, apart from the printed text? So I poked around, it took a long time. The most substantial collection outside of London is in Paris. It's connected with the correspondence of Jacques-Auguste Thou, the famous French historian. Quite a large number turned up unexpectedly in Copenhagen, which has fantastic collections which are badly catalogued. And we, at quite a late stage, we came across quite a few Scaliger letters also lurking in Copenhagen. So have a look. The Netherlands, of course, there were plenty. Where do we have? We got Leiden, The Hague, Utrecht, Leeuwarden. There are letters in Brussels, in Bale, in Zurich, Vienna, Uppsala. In Germany, we found quite a few letters in Hamburg and Munich, and even a few in Zwickau. And there are letters in Florence and Milan. I found a handful in New York and Philadelphia, and I even found one in Texas, which I didn't expect. Never been read. Well, I assume. It looks like it's never been read. this is a Thou letter. I'd love to know how it got there. There are some letters in Cambridge written in Greek, a useful little collection, and I think there are a few in Oxford somewhere. If anyone comes across any, by the way, on their travels and suspects that they might have escaped me, please let me know, because these things crop up all the time. And it's very, very hard to... I mean, the inventory is about as complete as these things can ever be complete, which means I need some help if you've got any letters. Anyway, as a result of a small British Academy grant last year, I was able to acquire copies of most of these manuscripts dotted around the world. And I've now compiled the inventory, such as it is. Just to give you some sense of the scale and proportions of the corpus of work we're talking about here, what we have in the inventory is about 2,400 letters from about 240 correspondents. Approximately half of the corpus survives in autograph, about 1,300 are from Casaubon, the rest are to Casaubon. Over 70% of the letters addressed to Casaubon have never been printed before. And in total we have about 900 letters of the correspondents which remain unpublished. Incidentally, I have on my computer, I have the inventory, so if anyone has a favourite correspondent they want to check up, I can probably tell you as much as I know. Okay, so the next thing, the inventory is available. Well, the inventory is done, it's not available. It's going to be available. Ideally, what we do at this stage is we do something like what we did with Scaliger. So we would put a lovely critical edition. Bearing in mind, Casaubon's language is unusually demanding, so you would like the reader to have as much help as possible with synopses and good footnoting. Unfortunately, as I said, there are about 2,400 letters. To put that into some context, there are about 1,600 Scaliger letters. That's coming out in 8 volumes, probably. I'm negotiating on the volume numbers. Quite fat volumes. Working up from how long it took us, it's going to take maybe 10 to 15 man years to do Casaubon in the way that Scaliger has been done. Now, I'd love to think there's a funder out there who wants to fund a Casaubon project on that scale, but I just don't think it's going to happen. So we needed to come up with an alternative plan. So what we're going to do is we're going to make a start on an online edition of the Casaubon letters. The core of this is going to be the inventory, and this will allow new material to be incorporated into the skeleton edition as and when it becomes available. So it's useful from the very beginning, but it can grow over time into something extremely sophisticated and hopefully complete. I think the reason that this needs to be, there are a number of advantages for having all this material, of course, available online. But probably the biggest one, and takes me back to the British Library manuscripts. These are 5 volumes of very well organised material that lay in a very accessible research institution, and they have been almost entirely unused. This seems like a terrible, terrible waste. The inventory and the online edition, or the online inventory and such as of the edition as we can establish, will at least bring this corpus of work to the attention of scholars. Okay, that's what I want to say about so on. This is all. This is sorry, could you grab one and pass it around. It's just the New Dictionary of National Biography entry on Thompson. This is partly, again, I put all the announcements saying, please send me some letters if you find them. This is to fix Thompson's name and dates into your head so that when you come across Thompson in your travels or your researches, you think, oh, I know a man who wants to know about Thompson, and you drop me a line. Please do. Thompson's material and evidence for Thompson's life is scattered very, very widely, and it's certain I've missed stuff. The challenge is bringing it all together, as I'll explain. Okay, Thompson, as I said, a much more obscure figure, a much more modest piece of research, one that I stand a reasonably good chance of actually finishing, which has got to be a good thing. I came across Thompson, of course, as one of Scaliger's correspondents. I published a book some years ago on, largely with early modern Bible translations. Thompson is one of the translators, one of the massive committees of translators that were assembled for the King James version of the Bible. So that made me interested for a start. But of course, like so many of these translators, almost nothing is known about him. So I turned to the Dictionary of National Biography entry. Now, this article is an advance on the first Dictionary of National Biography entry in the 19th century. But it depicted a man who was very, very different from the man I was beginning to get to know through Scaliger's correspondence. You may have it in front of you by now. Broadly speaking, there are three theological works, controversial in every sense of the word. In the first line, he's described as a philologist and a clergyman. And if you do get time to read it, you'll discover that there's plenty about him as a clergyman, but there's almost nothing in that article about him as a philologist. So this was the area of Thompson's life that I was interested in, that no one else seemed to be interested in. So I looked further into the matter. I found that Thompson's interesting enough, or I believe Thompson's interesting enough, and that there's enough evidence, there's a very substantial amount of evidence for Thompson out there, for a very, very different biography to be put together. One reason for the neglect of Thompson is that the evidence is very, very widely scattered. As I'll say in a minute, Thompson's career took him all over Europe. And one of the reasons Thompson has never been put together biographically is because the information is just so widely scattered that it's very, very hard for scholars working within national boundaries to get an overview. So I'm working now on a short monograph. It began as an article, but it's inevitably turned into a monograph, which is going to bring together some of these previously unconnected observations. It's also going to edit all of the surviving correspondence. There's no correspondence listed. I think it briefly mentions that he corresponded with Scaliger in that article. They're in the book that I'm preparing now. There are 75 letters and three poems, very short poems, very boring poems. Now, of this number, of this 75 letters, 41 have never been printed before. 12 are going to be printed in our edition of the Correspondence of Scaliger. And it's going to be the first critical edition of the remaining 22, I think that is. Well, since these new letters constitute the new evidence for Thompson's life, I should try and tell you, summarise something of what they're about and who they're from. All are in Latin. We don't have a single word in English from Thompson's pen, apart from what may be in the early books of the King James Bible. We have no way of identifying Thompson's responsibility for any English words in the King James Bible. The largest part of the correspondence is between Thompson and Casaubon. We have 11 letters from Casaubon to Thompson, all of which have been printed before. We have 22 letters from Thompson to Casaubon, only one of which has previously been printed. So there's a big chunk there, and they will neatly slot into the online edition of Casaubon as and when it gets started. The second largest group of letters is from Scaliger. We have 11 letters from Scaliger to Thompson, printed by Daniel Heinsius in 1627. We have a single surviving letter from Thompson to Scaliger, which has never been printed. Scaliger's celebrity ensured that his letters tended to survive. Thompson simply wasn't famous enough, so all his letters are lost. We have 8 letters from the French ambassador in London, Denis Perrault. We have 7 letters to the Leiden professor, Bonaventura Vulcanius. None of these have been printed before. There are 2 letters to the Dutchman Petrus Scriverius, one of which has never been printed. There's an unpublished draft of a letter from Scriverius. That'll be in there. There's a letter from Thompson to Janus Dursa Filius, One letter to Johan de Lett. Neither of these have been printed before. We have a letter to William Camden, which has been printed before in 1691, but the autograph survives, so it will be edited from the autograph in this book. There are three very short poems. One is from an album Amicorum, and two were prefatory preliminary verse for an edition of a Greek historian by Vulcanius. This sort of material is extremely hard to locate in your travels. If you come across liminal verse by Richard Thompson, please drop me an email, or by RT, as he's probably going to go under in some. There's bound to be something out there. I didn't discover the liminal verse, I only discovered it by chance. So what are the consequences of this new material for our understanding of Thompson? Well, first, it corrects a one-sided narrative of Thompson's career. Thompson's theological work has attracted a reasonable amount of attention, as you can see from that handout. His work as a scholar, moving among the greatest scholars of his day, has not attracted any attention, as far as I can see. Thompson was friends with Casaubon and Scaliger, and if he did nothing else, he introduced these two men to each other. So the world would have been different without Thompson. So that is at least some claim to fame. The second thing, it reveals an extraordinary mobility on the part of Thompson. This is relevant to the notion of networks. Let me try briefly to give you some idea. If I'd known I was going to have a whiteboard, I'd have a map up here and I'd be drawing arrows and lines on it. I don't. So I'm going to briefly skim through where he goes, because it's dizzying. His father seems to have been an English Protestant who lived in the Low Countries. Thompson Jr., my Thompson, was born about 1570, 1569, to a local woman. Born in Antwerp. Thompson Jr. was sent to Cambridge to study. This is in 1583. After graduating, he moves to his father's house in Germany in 1578. His father perhaps had been displaced by the religious wars in the late 60s, early 1570s. So his father's in Germany. Thompson then goes back to Leiden to do what we would think of as his postgraduate career. This is until 1591. In 1591, he also matriculates at the University of Heidelberg, which took me by surprise. So this is his third university, the second one we know he matriculated at. He returns to England after Heidelberg, 1591-92. He's then, in the following year, he's recorded at Geneva and at Frankfurt. He matriculates at the University of Franeker, University number 3, in 1593. And a few months later, he matriculates at London, fourth and final university I know he matriculated at. It wouldn't surprise me to find he matriculated somewhere else, it really wouldn't. So that takes us to 1593. Then, this is just halfway through this amazing decade. From Leiden, he goes back to Germany, then he moves back to England for 18 months. 1597, he sets out again, this time for Italy. Italy, he goes via Leiden, via Geneva, into Italy, then he goes Venice, Florence, Rome, standard path, and then back up. And except he takes a detour by Paris on the way back. We find him in Paris. And by 1600, he's back in Cambridge, and that's where he seems to have stopped. So throughout the 90s, he was constantly on the move. So this mobility had several consequences, one of which was that he went to all sorts of libraries, and he went to all sorts of places that sold books and manuscripts. He spent a lot of time in Florence and seems to have made good use of his time in Geneva, Heidelberg and Leiden. We know he was in the Palatine Library, we know he was in Florentine libraries. He accumulated a number of collations of manuscripts that he thought were important. Now, some people have cast doubt on the accuracy of some of these collations, but he had the eye to know that this manuscript was important and that it was worth collating. That said, he's left behind very few monuments to his scholarship. This is why we have the theological works and nothing else. We have a contribution of some description to Petrus Scriverius' ill-fated edition of Martial. We have possibly some written notes on Cicero's letters to Atticus, but these are just passing comments. As I said, his contribution to the King James Bible is impossible to determine. We just know that it happened. And yet, for a few years, he was regarded as one of the most promising scholars in Europe. a testament to this is that Casaubon is uncomfortable in Paris. Scaliger arrives in Paris in Leiden in 1593, and he attempts to have Casaubon brought to this relative safe haven of Leiden. That doesn't work. But Thompson's name is mentioned as a possible successor or possible alternative to Casaubon, possibly because he's cheaper. It doesn't work, it doesn't happen, but it does give you some idea of the way Thompson was thought at. He was a sort of rising young star for a few years. His later career maybe was something of a disappointment to him and possibly to other people, but for a while he really was a star. Thompson's mobility also ensured he was very well connected. He knew many of the great scholars of his day. He was on easy terms with the masters of several Cambridge colleges. He provides a link between the literary world of Cambridge in the 90s and the continent, and I think this is an avenue that's worth exploring further. For example, he was in Cambridge in 1591 when Spencer discussed his poetry with William Alabaster. Alabaster was a friend of Thompson's. This is interesting. What can we do with it? I don't know. I've mentioned the Camden letter. He knew Camden. Camden and Alabaster were friends before Thompson was a friend with Alabaster. There's an intriguing reference to a Dekker. Now, it's just possible that this could be Thomas Dekker, the playwright. I think there are two candidates for this. There's a Conrad Dekker who is studying in Leiden, and there's Thomas Dekker, the playwright. This would be the earliest mention of Thomas Dekker if it turns out to be Dekker. But this Anglo-Dutch literary set, London Centre, would be precisely where you'd expect to find Thomas Dekker, the playwright, at this date. So it's tempting. Thompson is an extraordinarily sociable man and restless. Obviously, he enjoyed all this travelling he did. And you see, he was very likeable. Everyone liked Thompson. And this is because he involved himself in people's lives. So he goes and stays with Casaubon. When he writes letters, he doesn't just say, write to Casaubon. He asks about the family. And he asks in a way that suggests he's genuinely interested. So many letters, we have so many perfunctory notes saying, oh, do say hello to your wife. They don't care. Thompson cares, and that's really endearing. We know about his visit to Paris, for example, because he made an impression on a correspondent of Scaliger's. This correspondent says, look, there he is, he's drinking beer, not drunk drinking wine. This letter is the reason I know the Latin word for potbelly, aqua liquorus. Only time I've ever read it, but apparently Thompson had one. Thompson was obviously a very... he probably knew Dutch, German, probably Italian, as well as English and his Latin and Hebrew and Greek. I have toyed with the possibility he might have known a bit of Arabic. That's as yet impossible to prove. But he has this trajectory through Europe, going from Crispin to Scaliger, which might indicate an interest in Arabic. But the most interesting avenue for future research on Thompson, I think, is opened up by his library. 1613, Thompson dies. We don't know what happens to his library. We lose sight of it. But 1633, Patrick Young, the royal librarian, apparently has in his possession some of Thompson's annotated books. I know of, four manuscripts and two printed books, which certainly pass through Thompson's hands in the British Library. I think there's good reason to suspect that there's a lot more from Thompson's library in the British Library at the moment. So perhaps next year, when I find some time, I'm going to settle myself down in the British Library and I'm going to start looking for them. But that's all I want to say. Thank you.